Hello, everyone. Well, Eva started out by saying we've moved away from the former session. I'm going to send us right back there, I'm afraid. there's a number of threads that I thought from the formal panel that I'd like to reinforce and make sure that you're mindful and making connections with my own. So we're looking at the cultural dimensions of linguistic barriers in healthcare. From our former discussions, I like some of these ideas that we've gathered. The idea that cultural communities may congregate in neighborhoods. The idea of cultural safety, the importance of creating spaces that are inclusive and engage diversity. And the idea that interpretation may not be the best answer, but in fact diversity in the workforce itself. And also the idea of early impact. We've seen that from yesterday, actually, in Dr. Savage talking about early childhood literacy, and we heard that today in terms of low fetal growth, for example, that the health of those mothers is something that has to be taken care of a lot sooner before the time that they're actually at the point of giving birth. So these are some of the ideas that I'm going to build on that we've had from the discussion so far today. So my background, I'm not a linguist, psychologist, epidemiologist, I'm a sociologist. I did my graduate work at York University in Carleton, and I taught for a number of years in the sociology department at Bishop's University. So how you see linguistic barriers and how you articulate the cultural dimensions of the barriers have something to do with the perspective that you bring to it. What is the barrier? Where is it? Well, that has to do with the framework that you're using to look at the situation. My starting point is that we're talking about a language community that shares a territory with a majority of another language. That minority is not institutionally complete. We've had a discussion of that today. So English-speaking Quebecers must, and for the most part, do pursue health and social service in the institutions of the majority. Those institutions are large, they're complex, even the majority has trouble negotiating them. They tend to be so centralized, and a little more increasingly so, with financial cutbacks, etc. The English-speaking population is low in terms of the representation that you might expect in the workforce. So we're talking about among health professionals, doctors, nurses, etc. We're also talking about social workers and, of course, mental health services, psychologists, etc. They're also low in terms of their representation and decision-making power in the institution. So if you're looking at boards of directors, etc., that have a say in health agencies, etc., the English-speaking minority individuals are not well represented at that level. That, of course, has a lot of implications. It means that they may not have a voice within the institution to the degree that they should, but it also means that they're not necessarily living in communities, neighborhoods, where they're rubbing elbows with doctors and nurses. Right? In other words, those professionals aren't as likely to be a member of their family, aren't as likely to be someone who they meet in their social rounds. I think we all know that when we're talking about the English-speaking minority, we're talking about some million individuals who are dispersed across a large geographical territory. So there's a certain amount of fragmentation in the community by virtue of geographical dispersion, but we also have something that we call cultural isolation or cultural fragmentation, if you want. So we've discussed the fact of how the English-speaking minority population in Quebec is highly diverse. If we compare that population to Francophones outside of Quebec, we compare that population to their majority with whom they share the same territory, we find that they have much higher proportions of non-Christian religious affiliation, for example. We see much higher proportions of immigrants, those who were born outside of Canada. We see higher proportions of individuals who are also members of visible minority communities. So it's a very particular feature of the English-speaking community that it is culturally diverse. We also have the growing phenomena of the development of a low-income group within the English-speaking population. And I think when we were talking about low fetal growth this morning, and Mr. Flock was able to question whether could there be a connection between the change in socioeconomic status and the development of these features that we're seeing in the healthcare services. So we've seen a growth of the low-income group, if you want, and that's by virtue of changes, mobility patterns, et cetera. Okay, when we're talking about access to health and social services, of course, we're talking about a key determinant of health that was previously mentioned as well. One of the ways of thinking about access to health and social services is simply, what is the level of institutional engagement by the particular group in question? So one of the concerns that has framed the kind of work that I've been involved in as a researcher is, how do we increase contact between professionals and the minority group through the system, for example? So it's, how do we increase contact between members of the English-speaking community and professionals to garner their expertise, garner their knowledge, etc.? How do we increase the level of health knowledge? This is where looking at promotion and prevention services is a very important aspect of health. So, yeah, we could look at the conversations that they're able to hold with respect to upcoming surgery, but we have to remember a lot of where health service and is effective is in our capacity to provide prevention and promotion materials, information, and this leads to the reduction of disease. In the case of the English-speaking community, there is a preoccupation with how do we increase information concerning the system itself. I don't know where to go. I don't know who to turn to. I don't know how to negotiate this institution that I increasingly feel is an institution that belongs to the majority and is not my own by virtue of the fact of the nature of the workforce, the nature of decision-making that takes place around that institution. A lot of the approaches and therefore the challenges and solutions that emerged in our discussion last evening, I noticed, centered around research that zeroed in on communication between doctor and patient in the medical setting. So the idea that comes from that is, how do we arm our professionals to speak the language, to offer culturally appropriate services to a better degree than we are at the moment? And so we get discussions around the complexity of communicating pain, the complexity of managing consent forms and documents in the institution that aren't available in English, and so on. And how do we improve the level of communication by training the expert, and the focus can be primarily on the expert in that case. How do we train nurses? How do we train doctors in the language? What I wanted to suggest is that is very important. Certainly when I go for surgery, I hope I can find someone who can speak to me in English. But that really is only a small part of a much larger picture. And I'd like to place that element, that communication between professional and patient, within the larger context. Also, to get away as an alternative, to focus away from the majority professional and to begin to think about the community side or the patient side. I think it's been pointed out, I think Anne pointed that out, that, you know, communication, it's never perfect. If any of you have been married for any number of years, you speak the language of your husband or your wife, But man, is communication difficult. So speaking the same language, even speaking the same language with great competency, is not necessarily a guarantee of cultural competency or the success of that communication at another level. And I think what Anne was pointing out is, you know, we speak French in many places around the world, but it doesn't mean we can assume a common culture. So we have to take into account the particular context and so on. This all fits nicely, as you can see, with my expertise as a sociologist and anthropologist, if you will, because they are known to, well, if an anthropologist wants to go in and study a disappearing culture, the first thing she or he will probably do is, yeah, it's probably a good idea to learn the language before I enter the field, but nonetheless, I must enter the field. I must go and live with these people for a while to learn their ways, learn their customs, put myself in their shoes, and understand the world from their perspective. And there's the practice of empathy and all kinds of things that you're trained. So what I wanted to suggest here, which we haven't talked about very much, but it does exist as an initiative in this context. It's also funded by Health Canada and so on. And it's more of a networking and partnership approach. And I've been doing a lot of work as a researcher with community health and social services and putting together, building knowledge and building research capacity actually in the community so that they can take ownership of their situation and make decisions regarding how to find solutions. So I'm going to suggest an approach where the professionals are in fact trained in how to be culturally appropriate by the community that they're attempting to serve. So we're talking about the training of professionals, perhaps, yes, but by the community that they ultimately want to serve, and in the context where, as we've put it so far today, I think there's a sense of cultural safety for the community or the minority group. So the approach is patient-centered. It's locally based. So the sense that if you want to address linguistic barriers, the cultural dimensions of linguistic barriers, let's find out where they're congregating in their neighborhoods. Where do we have English-speaking populations that form something of a critical mass? And how do we go to them, find out about their culture, and respond to them accordingly? When the institution is organized around the majority, you realize that where the majority forms a critical mass, where the English speakers form a critical mass, might not be one and the same. So the fact that you plant the institution for service here in Montreal, well, that might be difficult for some, how many, Jennifer, 300,000 who live off the island of Montreal and who for mental health services find themselves having to come to Montreal to get services in English, okay? So that's a sense of let's find out where they are, so let's make them locally based rather than centralized institutions, and let's see how we provide culturally appropriate services. So what the CHSN has done as part of its networking initiative is to train 19 coordinators, or we might call them mediators, I think, as they've been termed in this situation somewhat. They locate themselves in community organizations. So we have community regional organizations that are distributed around the province. They have located themselves or buddied up in various ways with those organizations. These are generalist community organizations. Sometimes it's taking a place through schools. Richard Boris mentions school is one of the final strongholds that, in fact, the English-speaking community has. And where you find schools, you tend to find community. So the schools have also been a venue. Here's the kind of thing that has taken place. The facilitator or the coordinator, what they're trying to do is facilitate institutional engagement. That is, bring together the community with the institution from which they have become disengaged, that they don't have a level of comfort with because it's not using their language and it's not seen to be an institution that belongs to their community. So they go in, and their job, in part, it's a lot more complex than that, and maybe Jennifer will talk to you about it, but it is to facilitate, to create that bridge, to link the community with the health services, health and social services available within their locale. They use, in some cases, technology for this, video conferencing. So from a long distance, you can have contact with a professional who's talking to you from a distance. But they're also doing this by simply a doctor, for example. Doctors are highly bilingual. Doctors who are willing to come to them in settings that they're comfortable with, like their schools or their community organization. The coordinator facilitates a situation of bringing a group of Anglophones together who share a common issue. It might be cancer, it might be diabetes, it might be caregiving and taking care of my elder parents, what have you. The topics vary. So the doctor, on a voluntary basis, as a matter of fact, quite often, from what I've understood, comes and engages the community. They don't look at that as a training situation, but I think we can see that that's in fact what it is. He steps out of his institutionalized role and enters into a setting where the minority is comfortable. They open up to him or her, and the discussion proceeds. And he goes away having understood what they're living on a day-to-day basis, what their lives are, where their issues lie, and speaks to them in their language. If you have a professional like a nurse who isn't able to speak English as comfortably as she probably would like, no problem. The facilitator's there. They work out the language in one way or another. As a matter of fact, in that particular setting, language becomes somewhat secondary because we're working together. We have goodwill in the room. We're in a setting that we're comfortable, and communication is managed. The technicalities of whether the vocabulary is all in place suddenly becomes secondary. There's a number of spin-offs from this because I know I'm losing time here. What I wanted to get at was the sense that from what you have here is improved access of the minority to professional expertise. That's one thing that we've obviously improved in access to health and social services. What often happens with respect to these facilitated situations happening locally throughout the province, neighborhood specific, so some of them will be primarily the South Asian community is attending today, or primarily the Filipino community is attending today. This moves, this depends on the neighborhood and where they congregate. What was I saying? Okay, so we have the improved access, we have institutional engagement. What often spins off from these groups is the development of support groups among the community members themselves. So, we attended a session together, we grilled the doctor on diabetes information in English. We don't leave it there. After that, we continue to meet on a weekly basis as a group. What we have there is social support. I have a group with whom I'm exploring the difficulties. I'm challenged to find information. We find it together. The group spins off from there. Here's another spin-off. You know what? Suddenly, after having met with the professional, trained the professional in my culture to the extent that I could, I feel more comfortable going back to the hospital. And next time, I'm not feeling as fearful or anxious regarding communication issues. There is the breakdown of a barrier on another level. I don't know what you want to call that level, but we do know from our CROP provincial survey that, you know, there are levels of anxiety and discomfort in using the institution, and breaking through that is a major hurdle in terms of improving access to health and social services. So the ultimate goal, and I think Roger Farley would be happy to hear that, is the reduction of health inequalities. I am managing to engage the institution, make use of the services. I have a health determinant that's operating in my life to improve my health all around. It could be that down the line, infant fetal growth will change as well. So I think the community developed model, the idea of giving more credit to, in a way, giving more credit to the community and its capacity to mobilize, to have a voice, and tell the professionals, and in fact, even train the professionals in what they need. Thank you.